The opinions expressed are those of the program hosts and guests and are not those of WPSL's staff, management, or sponsors. WPSL does not endorse products that may be mentioned. Any reproduction or retransmission of this broadcast is strictly prohibited without written consent of WPSL. It's time now for the Raybuck Law Firm Radio Hour, and here's your host, attorney Michael Raybuck.
Hello again, and happy Friday to you. This is attorney Michael Raybuck, and you are listening to the Raybuck Law Firm Radio Hour on AM 1590 WPSL. I'm chief counsel for my firm, Michael Todd Raybuck, PA, and we're located at 1025 Southwest Martin Downs Boulevard in Palm City, where we focus on two areas of practice: family law, including issues related to simple and complex divorce, spousal support, paternity, contempt, establishment, and modification of existing orders, division of assets and liabilities, dependency and children's issues. We also practice in personal injury litigation, representing clients who've been injured in auto accidents and negligence cases. In addition to being licensed by the Florida Bar, I'm certified by the Supreme Court of Florida as a family law mediator, admitted to practice before the United States Federal Courts of the Northern, Middle, and Southern Districts of Florida, as well as the United States Tax Court. The Radio Hour focuses our discussion on family law issues. Phone lines are open at 340-1590, and we'll try to answer your questions regarding a divorce or perhaps a time-sharing situation that you may have. This is an opportunity for free consultation. Family law attorneys, like most attorneys, we're very busy preparing our cases for court in between the various stages of litigation and research that goes into preparing for trial. We've got to find time to meet and consult existing and potential clients. There's not nearly enough time to satisfy the demand and need out there for answering all questions associated with family law. And many attorneys are also, like myself, business owners, and our time is further constrained by the time that we spend keeping our businesses properly managed. So this is a real opportunity for me, sort of a mutual opportunity for us on a sort of general and quite effective medium on topics of family law, which I have experience doing. I do have plans for an upcoming personal injury show. However, if you have a question regarding a family law matter or a personal injury case, call me at the office. My office's telephone number is 772-600-8166. I'll be glad to schedule a free consultation with you or speak to you personally on the phone regarding your case. You may also email me at michael@raybucklawfirm.com if you have a question that you'd like to have on the air or have me contact you about. You may visit our website at www.thefamilylawattorney.net. You can also email us right there on the website, and on the website you will also find our links for Facebook and YouTube. It's my goal to address issues that are pervasive to the profession as I see them. I was in court the other day. I was there on a fairly routine matter, waiting my turn before the judge, and as I was sitting there through the hearings and motions of the various cases that the judge was hearing, I began to think about how we might construct the Radio Hour around the different things that the parties go to court for, sort of not necessarily routine matters, because really you go to court, nothing is necessarily routine. And as I was sitting there, I sort of thought about this is how we can construct the hour, to sort of put together a couple of different subjects that might otherwise be unrelated, but because they're related to family law, they're sort of interconnected, and so that's what we're going to do today.
We kind of call that in this business show prep.
That's exactly what that is. And good morning, Veronica.
Good
How
morning.
Are you?
I'm well, thank you.
All right. Thank you for being here with me. Family law is a pervasive area of law, folks. It's very close to the community. And really, any time that I can take a moment when I'm in court and I just sort of take a moment to observe and think about things like that, it reminds me. There are so many different subjects that we can talk about. And just sort of to illustrate that, today we're going to talk about three somewhat unrelated aspects of what happens when you go to court on a family law matter. So let's get into that. And the first of the three subjects I'd like to tackle in the next 50 minutes has to do with a legal name change in Florida. Turns out that there's quite a bit to talk about with respect to something as what might otherwise be fairly simple concept of a legal name change in Florida. And the requirements for obtaining a legal name change in Florida laid out clearly in Florida Statute 68.07. For those of you who are interested in reading Florida statutes, you can go to a Google search and just type in Florida statutes, or like I do, Florida statutes annotated. You may read the citations that are referenced on the show, and just as a general matter, these are simply rules that the attorneys go by that are codified in Florida statute. For a legal name change, the state takes the opportunity at the outset to gather quite a bit of information about an individual who's applying for a name change. An adult name change, the mechanism for this process initiates through the filing of a form. Now, I've given you the website for these forms on just about every show, but again, it's www.flcourts.org. And the particular form in this case is called Petition for Change of Name, form number 12.982A. It's a four-page document. And in addition to basic information like name and address, this form is going to ask you for very important information which must be completed and filled out, asking for things like date and place of birth, names of both parents of the petitioner who's filing, all the addresses that that person has had since birth, if they're available, that the party's marital status, names and addresses of spouse and children, the occupation, and any criminal convictions or arrests, past bankruptcies, or whether your civil rights have ever been suspended. This stuff is all going to be required, so before you go to a final hearing to have this addressed, that's going to have to be made part of the record. Additionally, this form is going to ask for information about a business that a person might own, possession of any advanced degrees, and any past name changes and or aliases that they may have gone by or go by presently. Form's got to be notarized, and you must affirm that the name change is not intended for any illegal purposes and will not violate anyone else's privacy, trademarks, patents, or property rights. Now, as we've stated, that this form can be found online, but can also be found at any state circuit courthouse in Florida or through the state's website. It must be filed, however, in the county of the party's residence. At the time of filing, typically the petitioner is going to have to provide a set of fingerprints taken by a law enforcement agency. That's not the case in every scenario, however, and there's two marked distinctions, which I'll cover in just a moment. But in addition to the petition form, the party is going to need to fill out a generic name change final judgment form. So you're going to have the proposed final judgment form with you when you go to the final hearing, and then the judge can simply sign it if he or she agrees to grant your name change. There is a fee associated with the filing of a petition for name change, and in Florida, I believe, I'm 99% sure that fee is $400. That fee can be waived if the petitioner is indigent. A qualifier for indigency, meaning they don't have the ability to pay, a party that wants to file can't pay the fee, that person must file the appropriate form claiming indigent status, and the clerk will sort of run the numbers based upon a party's statement or sworn statement of income and ability to pay. The factors that are primary to determining whether a person is indigent is really what they make or what income that they may or may not have and the number of people that live with them in their home. After the filing of the petition papers, the petitioner is going to have to go before a circuit judge to have the name change granted. There's no way around the final hearing. There's going to have to be a final hearing in front of a judge for this process to be completed. And the judge has final discretion and will or can generally deny the name change if a petitioner has, you know, certain circumstances come up, like, for example, they're not able to prove legal residency in the state, or if there's determined to be some ulterior or illegal motives behind the change, or maybe if the new name interferes with someone else's rights. What I mean by that is, for example, a requested name change to something like Coca-Cola Johnson or maybe Walmart Sam, that probably is going to be denied for violating a trademark, while a name that's changed to a symbol, say you wanted to change your name to ampersand or maybe question mark, that might also be denied if it's deemed by the court.
Or the rocker formerly known as Prince.
Yeah, that's the one I thought of when I, that's right, yeah. I was thinking about whatever that thing was.
But then,
that,
you know, what do you call him?
What did we end up doing with that? I don't remember what he called himself.
I think he went back to his name. I don't know.
It caused too many problems, and so they had. It probably what happened was the IRS got involved.
I'm sure
on that
Prince
one.
Wasn't real in the first place. So
that's right. His name's Harold something or other.
Yeah, his mama gave him a name, I'm sure.
But those types of efforts will typically be denied if the court determines that there will be any interference with things like the functions of legal or tax collection processes. And so the bottom line is, if you're going to do a name change, it is a serious matter, and a serious name will get serious consideration by the court.
Do the majority of the people who change their name would be like a woman who's now divorced, wants to go back to her maiden name, or she just doesn't want to have her husband's name anymore or her ex-husband's name?
Yes, that's very typical.
That would be the majority. Okay, so it would be the same process, though. You'd have to, I mean, it doesn't come automatically with the divorce.
That's correct.
You have to go down and change it later.
Well, actually, you can change back to a former name as part of the divorce process.
Okay.
It'll have to be pled. Well, ideally, it would be pled in the initial petition pleadings. Mm-hmm. And then at the final hearing, the judge will take testimony and will grant, okay, the former name is restored. All part of the same process.
Okay.
No additional cost associated with that. Mm-hmm. And nice and easy. But, of course, what happens sometimes is that doesn't get addressed at the final hearing. The final judgment is done. And that party ultimately has to go back and do it then.
Oh, wait a minute.
I wanted my name changed.
I forgot about that. Okay.
Right. So, assuming a name change is granted, what's going to happen, just to give you a procedural background of how this goes and where the $400 is applied, the judge is going to order the clerk to send the change of name to the Office of Vital Statistics, to the Department of Health, which will then make it a permanent record of the state. So you can be assured once that final judgment is done, you get your certified copies. The process is going to be put in place that your name change is now going to be applied, and it's going to be applied statewide. The clerk's going to be ordered to send the new information to FDLE, and they're going to inform the Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles, and then you're going to get your new identification under your new name. And in a situation where a petitioner who gets granted a name change is born in another state, that party can file a certified copy of the judgment and forward it to their state, and then the official records indicating who they are and where they're from, that will all be changed as well. I had a question on this issue last week. My client basically asked, when I got married, I changed my last name to my husband's. Now we're getting divorced. I want to change my maiden name back. So it was a relevant mm-hmm. question to ask. And so, like we were just talking about, people want to get their names changed. They do so after a divorce. The wife will want to go back to a maiden name, which is completely understandable. There's no fingerprint standard if you want to go and have a former name reinstated, which is one of the big differences with respect to just getting a name change. I want to change my name to...
And you make it up.
Michael something or other.
Yeah.
Or maybe change my first name. This situation doesn't require a lot of the formalities. The bottom line, you'll have a much easier time with the judge by just filling out the proper forms when all you want to do is go back to a former name.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a much simpler process.
Now, if you change your name to something totally different, you make it up, you want to be somebody else. Now, do all of these names follow you? Like, okay, I was born this name, I got married, now I had this name, now I'm changing my name, so now I have three different names. Do those names all cross-reference? You know, if you were to get in trouble or something, I mean, formerly known as, do these AKAs all come up?
Yeah, I would say mm-hmm. so. As a matter of course, they do. And also, in your personal life, you're going to have people who know you as certain names, and they may take them forever to get over what they've always called you.
Sure.
When, in fact, they may have to apply themselves to call you by your proper name. And mm-hmm. that goes along with business. They're going to have to address you as the proper name when they're doing things of a business nature
sure.
to make sure that they don't say things incorrectly. So, yeah, I mean, the practical and reality answer is yes.
I mean I'm thinking even just getting credit, looking at who are you,
Absolutely.
Who are you now?
Absolutely. It can become a complication as much mm-hmm. as it may become a non-hindrance. I mean, the bottom line is if you're changing your name, all of those things will have to be addressed. Credit card companies may have outdated information for you. I mean, certainly you've been in situations where you've gotten things that are sent to your wrong address because maybe there was some oversight mm-hmm. by the people that who were supposed to mail you something, maybe a bank, or perhaps it was a situation where you simply forgot to notify people of your change. It's the same way when you change a name. I mean, there can be complications, and ultimately that becomes something that's on the individual to, I'm this person now. I've changed my name, and this is my legal name, and for the record, I'm going to file something with you, credit card company or bank or mortgage lender or whoever, and just call me this net from now on
right.
so that there's no confusion. But, even if you do all those things, it's still a matter of the other side processing the paperwork and making sure that they mm-hmm. know who you are.
Right.
So, probably a good policy to just stick with your name unless it's absolutely unnecessary to do so.
Well, I would think, too, if you have children, then you might, as a mother, I would want my name to stay the same as my children.
Absolutely, and that can become...
If I had no children and I was being divorced, then I think maybe, I'd want to go back to my maiden name.
Right.
Which would probably be more simple than coming up with something totally different.
I agree with that, and it's very common, very pervasive for that to be an issue. Children is an interesting issue because your children grow up with a network of friends who get to know you, if you are in the situation you're describing, mm-hmm. as Mr. and Mrs.
Yeah.
And so that doesn't change necessarily when you've gone back to a former name. And that will go on and on and on until you decide, you know, I can live with this and it's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. I have a different name than my children, or not. Or you can decide, you know what, this is something I need to really get fixed because everyone still knows me as this and I'm kind of comfortable with it and I want to have the same name as my children. And that's the other thing. Sometimes it's a process. You get that name changed as part of the divorce because you just want that name gone. And then you may change your mind. Perfectly understandable. We've got a call. Frank from Port St. Lucie. You are on the line. How can I help you, Frank?
How are you? I'm in a bit of a dilemma. And I had some, what they call titanium mini dental implants put in a couple of years ago by a local dentist in Port St. Lucie. And they're the whole dentures in place. And I'm an older guy, retired on a fixed income, which gets me a little peeved now. The treatment was never finished. When I went back for the scheduled time, after several problems with the implant, my body rejecting them, I went back to get the treatment finished, and he wasn't there, the dentist. He had sold the practice. He quit working. They told me he was sick. And it was like why didn't you notify me or something? Well, it was like sudden. We didn't even realize that all of a sudden he's here and he's not. Well, I had to go to a guy in Lakeland. He's the best implant guy in the state for these mini implants. Long story, but the guy in Lakeland is excellent. Believe it or not, he gave me a bit of a discount for driving so far. Turns out my dentist, he was sick all right. Had a cocaine problem. His license was taken away by the state health department.
Let me interject for a moment. Do you have a question with respect to a personal? Is this a personal injury matter? You were injured.
I sued the guy in small claims court to get my money back if he's practicing on me. Never finished the treatment, and he was a drug addict.
All right. Listen, a situation like this, we may be looking at a personal injury case. I'd like to know something about the status of a lawsuit that had been filed. If there had been small claims, I'd want to know the background with respect to that information. What I would probably do in this case, give me a call at the office, set up a consultation. I'll be glad to speak with you for free, up to 30 minutes with respect to that issue. We can find out background about your case. If it's something that that we can assist you with, we would be certainly happy to do that. And you can contact me at the office at 772-600-8166, or if you feel more comfortable emailing me, just send me an email at michael@raybucklawfirm.com, include your phone number or contact information, and I'll certainly follow up with you so we can discuss the details of that issue. And thank you for calling, Frank. The issue regarding divorce papers that don't show a request for name change. That's something that you were talking about earlier, and I wanted to address that real quick. Florida's handles it differently than in other states. In most states, you'll most likely still be able to restore your old name. If you have some documentation that has your old name on it, such as a birth certificate or passport, then there won't be a whole lot to worry about. And there are some states that actually require, for purposes of a name change, that all you do is you start using your old name again and you request that your name be changed on all of your personal records. So we're talking about how things work in Florida. They don't necessarily work the same in all states. And in some states, it's a very informal process, whereas with Florida, we've got a specific process, which is fairly formalized. In Florida, like we were talking about, you're going to be a lot less likely to run into problems when restoring a previous name that you used before marriage than if you want to make a completely new name change. You're not going to have fingerprint issues, and like we talked about, I don't know whether offhand an indigent person is going to be able to have the fees waived with respect to fingerprinting and records check type issues in the circumstance of a name change for just, I want to change my name. But my thought is that the fees would be waived. The information would be available at the clerk's office with respect to that issue. And the clerk of court can instruct you on the process of having the fingerprints taken and submitted, including information on law enforcement agencies or service providers to submit fingerprints electronically to the Department of Law Enforcement. So just to wrap up this issue of fingerprinting and name change, you're going to want to get a hearing date for the court to consider your request. If you're seeking to restore a former name, a hearing on the petition may be held immediately after the petition is filed. I guess the theory on the consistent idea here is if you're just going back to file a formal name change, it's going to be a relatively simple process. You can get a hearing almost immediately if the judge is available. Given that this is the Christmas season, the courts are pretty stacked with respect to uniform motion calendar and just expanded hearing times. People want to get their cases heard before Christmas. It's a little bit more difficult. But in the general sense, if you have a former name change that you want to go back to, that can be done right away. You should ask the clerk of court, family law intake staff, or the judicial assistant about the local procedures for setting a hearing. And you may be required to attend the final hearing with the name change form, as I've indicated. That's going to be something that the judge is going to require that you bring along. It's a Supreme Court-approved family law form. The judge is going to use that, most likely, to grant or deny your petition for name change. If you should type or print the heading, including the circuit, county, and case number on your form, that's going to be helpful. I mean, the form is fairly standard. You can, like I said, you can find it online, and everything should be more or less included with respect to the party's names. The rest of it, there's like a blank space for the judge to put in any dicta or information that they feel is necessary, but more than likely, if everything is in place, all of the form items that they've requested are provided, the judge is going to sign that and grant your name change.
How legal, I mean, is the name? You say I have a new boyfriend, he comes to live with me, and I start using his last name, but we're really not married, but I just start doing that on my own. Am I in any trouble?
If you just change your name?
Well, I'm just using it.
I suppose it would depend if it would be what kind of purposes it would be used for. Okay. If you were using it to get credit, for mm-hmm. example, there might be a problem.
Okay.
If you're not paying your bills subsequent to that, it would be something that eventually it's going to be getting looked into.
Okay.
And there would be potential civil, if not criminal, penalties associated with something like that under that scenario. But, I mean, if you're doing something in good faith and nothing illegal ever comes of it, mm-hmm. can you just do that?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if it would necessarily be enforceable in some ways, but could you do it? Sure.
It's a weird situation. I knew a woman who was married but separated from her husband. They never got divorced. And she had a new husband, so to speak, for like 20 years. They never married. She never got the other guy's name. She carried the other. But she then used her, I guess they would be common law, but we don't have that in this.
Well, no,
Florida,
it was
right?
common law. It was like an alias.
Like,
it was like an alias.
Okay,
name.
I guess.
Yeah, aliases are something that's going to show up possibly on a credit report. I've been in situations where I've had to look up information
that just seems
on
messy.
People. And,
oh,
absolutely,
yeah.
It's messy.
Yeah.
And there'll be situations where people do this. Obviously, that wasn't a bigamy situation because there was no subsequent marriage.
No, exactly.
But there'll be situations where you look up credit reports and there'll be aliases provided for people that are going by various names, and you'll find out that they've taken credit out under various names. And the bottom line is if they're paying those bills,
no one cares.
Not a whole lot goes on with it. But of course, when there's non-payment, well, then it's a different situation.
Mm-hmm.
Then there could be criminal sanctions.
Yeah, who are we looking for? Wait a minute.
I'm looking for Joe Jones / Johnson / Smith / uh-huh. you know. And so that type of thing, I suppose it's fairly common, actually.
Yeah, this was just, I guess, an agreement kind of thing. Yeah, we're not really divorced, but we haven't been together for 20 years. And
so let me complicate my life by changing my name a couple more times.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but not legally.
No, and that's a great point. That's a way to end this segment. Even with all of this in place, there's may still be paperwork barriers that a person has to jump through in order to get everything changed to what's requested. If a petitioner is a recent immigrant, for example, or cannot find appropriate documentation of a former name, there may be obstacles to getting a name change. The bottom line, for more involved questions on things like this, you should contact an attorney to address the particulars of your case. We're going to take a quick break. This is Attorney Michael Raybuck, and you're listening to the Raybuck Law Firm Radio Hour on AM 1590 WPSL.
Fox News Talk. This is WPSL Port St. Lucie, the talk of the Treasure Coast.
FNN News, I'm Deborah Roberts. Governor Rick Scott says he wants to sit down with President Barack Obama to talk about Florida's options under the Affordable Care Act.
Rick Scott and other GOP governors wrote to the president saying they have dozens of questions about the implementation of Obamacare.
We care about those that can't afford their health care, but we've got to be able to afford a health care safety net that our citizens are able to pay for, especially this time where it's a tough time for families.
Scott was fighting against the Affordable Care Act even before he became governor, but after the November elections, he admitted the state will have to go along. Today's the deadline for states to decide how to handle health insurance exchanges, and Florida will have to default to the feds. Rick Flagg, Tallahassee.
Charges against a Melbourne man accused in the death of a teenager during an argument over loud music at a gas station in Jacksonville have been upgraded. Michael Dunn was facing second-degree murder in the death of 17-year-old Jordan Davis, but now he's facing first-degree murder and could be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole if convicted. Investigators say the 46-year-old Dunn fired into a vehicle with four teens inside after complaining about loud music coming from the vehicle. Davis was killed. Dunn, who was in Jacksonville for his son's wedding, says he saw a gun. Meanwhile, a state law making it illegal to blast loud music from a car stereo has been declared unconstitutional. The Florida Supreme Court on Thursday ruled in a pair of Pinellas County cases. Both motorists were cited for playing their car radios too loudly. The justices called the law unconstitutional and said it violates free speech rights for several reasons, including that it exempts vehicles used for business or political purposes. The high court did not have a problem with the requirement in the law that a stereo must be plainly audible from 25 feet or more in order to be illegal. A lower court had questioned the constitutionality of that standard. Instead, justices ruled that people do have a right to play amplified music and that the law is intrusive. With news on the Florida News Network, I'm Deborah Roberts.
Hey, I'm Brandon. The disease I got from smoking led to me having both of my legs amputated. It's called Berger's disease. That's where your blood vessels can get blocked because of blood clots. That can destroy your skin tissue and lead to infection, gangrene, or worse. In my case, it started on my left foot. Eventually, I had to have my leg surgically removed just below my knee. I was 19. A few years later, I had to have my right leg removed too. I was a double amputee at 23 years old. The reason that happened was because I smoked. So I have a tip in case that happens to you. Take showers instead of baths and use a shower chair. You'll find bathtubs are a lot harder to get in and out of when you don't have legs. Some of you might think I'm just making all this up. I wish I were.
Find three ways to quit at tobaccofreeflorida.com. Call, click, or come in.
He's back in the U.S. and talking about his strange odyssey. Antivirus software founder John McAfee says American authorities have made no effort to question him since he arrived in Miami after weeks of evading Belizean authorities accusing him of involvement in the death of his neighbor, Greg Fall, who owned the Tailgaters restaurant on the UCF campus. McAfee says he's innocent.
When someone storms your property with guns, threatens your life, shoots your dog, and then says, are you going to pay us the $2 million now? Wouldn't you think your life might be in danger if you don't pay the money?
McAfee was deported from Guatemala after sneaking in illegally from Belize. U.S. officials say there's no active arrest warrant for McAfee that would justify taking him into custody. Federal customs agents say they have seized cocaine worth an estimated $2.7 million hidden in luggage from Ecuador at Miami International Airport. No arrests have been made, and it wasn't immediately clear what happened to the owner of the bags. For more news you care about, go to myflanews.com. I'm Deborah Roberts, FNN News.
You're listening to the Ray Buck Law Firm Radio Hour on WPSL 1590. Now back to your host, Attorney Michael Raybuck.
Welcome back. This is Attorney Michael Raybuck. You're listening to the Law Firm Ray Buck Law Firm Radio Hour on AM 1590 WPSL. If you have questions about a family law or personal injury matter, call me for a free consultation at 772-600-8166. Email me at michael@raybucklawfirm.com. And Raybuck is spelled R-E-B-U-C-K. Visit our website, www.thefamilylawattorney.net. Email me there as well, or you can find our leaks on Facebook and YouTube. We're talking about name change in Florida, and I want to just expound on a follow-up issue with respect to that regarding children's issues and a name change that's relevant to getting children's names changed to a party's former name. This would be an example of a spouse, a wife spouse, who has changed her name to her former name and now wants her children to have that name. So let's talk a little bit about that because it's actually a relevant subject to what we've been talking about today. Many courts have traditionally held that the father of a child has the right to insist that the child continue to use the father's last name as long as the father continues to fulfill his duties as a parent. Well, that's pretty innocuous language or somewhat rudimentary language, and although this traditional rule is apparently still used by many courts, some jurisdictions are changing the way they approach this issue. Florida certainly has a much different way of approaching the issue. Florida does not adhere to issues like gender when determining things like the best interest of the child. Under current laws and trends, a court may order a child's name to be changed to the mother's maiden or former name in a situation where it's clear that doing so is in the best interest of the child. To do that, courts are going to look at a number of factors when making this decision, and things would be that like that would include the age of the child, the strength of the mother-child relationship or the nature of that relationship, how long the child has used the father's name, any potential negative impacts that the child may suffer if the name change was ordered, and any benefits to changing the name. I guess in that situation, one sub-factor would be whether the mother remarries. Courts will need to balance those factors against the depth of the father-child relationship. In the end, what it really comes down to with respect to that question is what's in the best interest of the child. The court's not going to get caught up in semantics or preferences other than to address a child's best interest based upon the facts and information that's provided by the parties. And I'll caveat to all of this and to our discussion generally regarding name changes. Even if a party is successful in getting a court order that changes the children's name to a person's own maiden name or former name, you cannot change the legal relationship that exists between the father and the children. A lot of times these subtextual issues get tied up in things as simple or otherwise innocuous as a name change. A name change for some people is extremely important. In fact, I would say in most cases it's extremely important. You know, one goes to the trouble of spending the money and the time for getting a name change if it's not important to them. It's a very personal and subjective issue. So though issues like, okay, well, how does this affect the relationship between the other party and my children? That is inexorably tied to this type of proceeding in a person's mind. And so it can become a factor or become part of the process. And changing names is not going to change any rights or responsibilities of either parent when it comes to visitation, child support, or even things like intestacy or inheritance rights. These changes will only come about if apparent responsibility is changed by a court order. And now we're talking about things like modifying a time-sharing agreement or a parenting plan, or, of course, in a situation where a child is adopted by a step-parent. And finally, if a parent is planning on getting remarried and the new spouse is going to adopt the child through step-parent adoption, part of that adoption process can be a name change for the child. So that's pretty much how I wanted to summarize name change. Obviously, if you have questions regarding a name change or something related to that, please give me a call at the office. I'm going to move on to a little bit different direction here. I wanted to address a question regarding change of venue, completely unrelated to what we were just speaking of earlier. So let's talk a little bit about what is venue. It's a legal term that basically determines in the case of a divorce. Let me just qualify this. We're talking about family law issues today. So for purposes of our venue discussion, we'll be talking about family slash divorce issues. And venue in a divorce case determines where a divorce action is filed. The Florida statute that's relevant here is 47.011. And a divorce action can be brought wherever a respondent, a party who to be served, lives, or where the parties last lived as a married couple. In cases where the children live in one county because a parent moved there after separation, the case can still be filed in the original county where the parties last lived as a married couple. The respondent in that situation might move for a change of venue, but it's at the court's discretion after testimony whether to move venue in that scenario. The significance of this might be sort of out there, but it really starts to come clear when you focus on the issue, because venue is actually a very important aspect of the procedural process in Florida and in other jurisdictions. Venue might not be as important to the parties if one party lives like in an adjacent county. Here, St. Lucie and Martin are sort of like sister counties almost. Mm-hmm. And I live in Martin County, and it's very simple for me even to come all the way up here to Fort Pierce. It's a 25-minute drive. Something like that might not be a big deal. But if the parties live in different areas of the state, which is also very common, a party might argue for venue in his or her county because of the cost of litigation. For example, if you retain, say, a Bartow, Florida county attorney, Polk County, But the venue of your case is in Dade or, say, even Martin or Palm Beach County. Your attorney is going to charge for travel costs to attend the hearing or hearings in those counties, unless the attorney can talk the court into letting him or her appear by telephone. Now, some judges simply, as a matter of discretion, do not allow telephone hearings. But even in situations where they do, judges are going to have certain things that are required that all parties attend. And the judge ultimately has that call. And if a judge orders as part of an order for hearing that the parties be present, they have to be present. The phone option is not available. So when venue becomes an issue in a family case, venue allows the courts to simply rule fairly as to where an action should be brought. And there are very particular statutes and rules with respect to these types of issues. If the parties live far apart without venue laws, venue is going to be a bone of contention. And you can certainly count on that becoming part of the motion practice in situations where there's attorneys on both sides and venue is an issue. Neither party is going to want the expense of litigating a divorce action on the other side of the state, if it's at all possible.
Is it automatically going to happen in the county where the person filed?
No. It's not automatically going to happen.
Oh, it's going to happen where they were last, where they lived together last.
I actually may have missed the last part of that question. What's going to happen is they're going to file somewhere. They're mm-hmm. going to file in a county. It may not be the appropriate county. And frankly, if nobody argues about that issue, say the parties live in two separate counties mm-hmm. and they file in a third county right here in Florida. Let's just say, for example, one lives in Indian River and one lives in St. Lucie. And for some reason, maybe work or something, they file in Martin. If nobody says anything about that, it's probably going to go through. It'll probably be processed, and if the parties don't have an issue with respect to venue, Martin County will probably ultimately hear that case okay. and resolve it. So I guess the question really comes down to wherever they file, venue could then thereafter become an issue if one of the parties is unhappy
okay.
with the location.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's not always tethered to things like it's inconvenient for me. There could be other reasons that a party feels that venue is not proper. I'll cover those in just a moment, but you've heard of like situations where a person is viewed as despicable or odious among the public. Situations like that might be a reason for a change of mm-hmm. venue, even though mm-hmm. it might have otherwise been proper.
Sure, I have to live in this town.
Yeah, exactly,
and
right.
And people
that's
might
right.
be mad at me.
Yeah, so venue is what allows the courts to rule fairly as to where an action should be brought. If the parties live far apart without venue laws, it's going to be a bone of contention. The venue law basically keeps parties from fighting over where a divorce action should be filed. Now, time frame.
You give them one more thing to fight about.
It's part of the process. Yeah. That's right. And the bottom line is if you want to get right down to it, there are many issues that you can make a part of motion practice, and venue is certainly one of them. It becomes a critical issue with especially with things like expense. Regarding the time frame, there's a time frame element to when you can address a venue change. A party may request a change of venue because he or she thinks that they're not going to receive a fair trial in the proper venue because the person requesting that change, like we said, there's a despicable or odious element to it. It's rare in divorce cases because it's a judge that hears a case, not a jury. It's one,
right.
And the judge
mm-hmm.
is not going to be impartial a judge is going to be impartial with irrespective of those types of issues because they're trained to do that, and that's not an issue. But nonetheless, in a situation where you've got a public figure as a client, a public figure could have issues even in divorce cases. And so the bottom line is, even though we're only dealing with judges with respect to this issue, family law case, a public figure could move for a venue change under certain circumstances. And if that's the case, they typically have to motion for that change of venue within 10 days after the filing of the divorce, unless there's good cause for why there was a delay. We've got Paul on the line. Paul's got a question. Good morning, Paul. How can I help you?
Good morning. Question on power of attorney.
Yes, sir.
Bring up a few different subjects for you.
All right.
Mom, it's a 40-year-old adult, mentally challenged, and she's been his primary caregiver since birth. But going into living on his own, he's pretty capable, but as far as money and medical and stuff goes, probably needs to have something set up. She never did get guardianship because she was always his guardian, and it was never brought up or questioned. But now at this stage in his life, it's probably a good idea to get something in place as far as his controlling his money, you know, and not having anybody take advantage of him that way.
Well, Paul,
can that be done with pretty much a simple power of attorney?
Yes. It sounds like in your circumstance, a power of attorney would be appropriate. And, Paul, just so that you know, I will handle those on a case-by-case basis. If you are interested in contacting me after the show or emailing me, you've got my phone number and email. Again, my phone number is 772-600-8166. And it does sound like it's a fairly simple matter of putting that power of attorney together. We would need to put the particulars in place, but given that information that you provided, it does sound that that would be appropriate and it would be something that would be relatively simple to do. Okay. We had been talking about time frame for venue, and the change of venue statute has several features written into it that make it easier for parties to get a fair trial, to make it easier for the parties or to make it easier for witnesses to testify on behalf of the parties. If the proper venue is a hardship on the parties because both parties moved after separation and live in different counties, remember we're talking about a divorce situation here, then in that circumstance, either party can apply for a change of venue to an appropriate court with jurisdiction. This allows the parties to stipulate to a different venue if both parties believe it is in their best interest to move venue. If after a change of venue, the court determines that it's not in the interest of one or both parties, then by the statute, the court's going to change that venue back to the original venue for, some would say, the convenience of the parties. Another feature of the venue statute is that testimony of witnesses can be taken by alternative methods, such as telephone or video appearance. This, again, would be discretionary for the judge. But in the end, if a judge requires the presence of all parties at a hearing, that's going to be what ultimately happens. And then the issue of misconception regarding jurisdiction and venue. Attorneys get caught up on this more often than you would otherwise think. People often confuse jurisdiction and venue, so it would be important to point out the differences right here. Venue means location, where an action is going to be brought, where it's going to be heard. Jurisdiction is a little bit different in speaking sort of holistically here. Jurisdiction basically means that the court has the authority to hear a certain case, such as a divorce case. And unless the parties agree to change venue, the court cannot order a change of venue without hearing testimony unless it's clear that the case was originally filed in the wrong venue. Now, depending on local rules, even if it's clear that the case was filed in the wrong venue, the court might still require testimony as to the change of venue. So jurisdiction has to do with the authority of a court. Florida, just to give you a brief primer on how this works, Florida's got 67 counties. Each of them have their own county court. But there are 20 circuit courts in the state of Florida, which is then each of them are basically comprised of different county courts. Here in the 19th Judicial Circuit, our circuit is comprised of Indian River, St. Lucie, Okeechobee, and Martin counties. And cases for unified family court or for family court are all under the auspices and jurisdiction of circuit court. Then, of course, you've got appeals courts in Florida. There are five of those called district courts of appeal. And, of course, the Supreme Court, which watches over everybody up in Tallahassee. So venue is actually the place, the location where a case is going to be brought, where it's going to be heard, where it's going to be decided. The jurisdiction within that court is relevant to its authority to actually hear a case. An example of this is you would not bring a divorce case in county court. You wouldn't take it to the Supreme Court or an appeals court. The jurisdiction of the original jurisdiction of a family court case is circuit court. We're going to take a brief break here, and we'll be right back to finish up on venue.
The Avenue D Choir, known along the Treasure Coast for their joyful singing, invites you to their production of No Orphans, an original stage play depicting the life of a young boy, his challenges, bad choices, and his quest to fill the voids along the way. No Orphans is filled with singing, dancing, and holiday music. Its storyline speaks to all of us. Don't miss No Orphans, Friday, December 21st at Faith World in Port St. Lucie. Call 595-1414 for tickets and information. Proceeds will benefit the Avenue D Choir. Celebrate the 12 days of Christmas with WPSL. Register to win a $50 gift certificate from Bella Roma on Bayshore Boulevard, Port St. Lucie, home of the Lobster Tail Pastry. Or register for a $50 gift certificate to the 19th hole and Sandpiper Room at the Saints Golf Club on Morningside Boulevard, Port St. Lucie. You'll be entered in the grand prize drawing for a tablet computer from C&W Computers, South Federal Highway in Stewart. Register now and happy holidays from WPSL. You're listening to the Ray Buck Law Firm Radio Hour on WPSL 1590. Now back to your host, attorney Michael Raybuck.
Welcome back. This is attorney Michael Raybuck. And if you've got questions about family law or personal injury, call me for a free consultation at 772-600-8166. Email me at michael@raybucklawfirm.com or visit our website at www.thefamilylawattorney.net. We're talking about change of venue, and that concept has the potential to significantly affect the outcome of a divorce case. If venue is changed through application of the court because one of the parties does not agree, it can affect that party's ability to attend hearings. Party's appearance is required at most hearings in divorce court in Florida, and because the rulings at these hearings can significantly change the way one or both parties ultimately live their lives during and after the divorce process. If one of the parties cannot afford to attend a hearing, he or she may not be able to testify as to her side of the claims of the petition, may not be able to attend a mandatory appearance hearing, and what will ultimately happen in situations where the judge has ordered mandatory appearance is the party or parties are going to incur sanctions by the court, and those sanctions can include dismissal of claims, dismissal of elimination of defenses, a number of things, including attorney's fees, which could be sanctions, which ultimately hurt the party's case and can certainly make their case have limitations that would not otherwise have. But that's basically the idea behind venue. It is the location where the party will bring an action, where the parties will hear an action, and more or less summarizes what we were talking about with respect to venue and change of venue issues today. Now, I had intended on discussing premarital agreements, prenups, as what's regularly.
You may need a whole show for that.
I'm going to need a whole show for that. There is no way we're going to get through a whole hour of talking about prenups, but I am going to begin to interject on that. And I think what we'll do is expound upon this on a later show. But I do want to talk about prenups a little bit. We've got a few minutes left, so why don't we go ahead and get started on that. The statute for prenuptial agreements is codified in Section 61079. And this particular section is also cited as the Uniform Premarital Agreement Act. This particular section of 61, Statute 61, applies only to proceedings under the family law rules of procedure and not to other provisions of the Florida statutes. So things like probate, other things not related to family law, these rules would not apply in those situations. Sticking strictly with family law type issues. And a premarital agreement is essentially, it's an agreement that's between a prospective spouses made in contemplation of marriage and to be effective upon marriage. Property, which is almost always the subject of a prenup or a premarital agreement, is something that basically includes but is not limited to. There's that phrase that you hear attorneys say. The property includes but
it's
is not
gray
limited
area,
to.
Right?
Yeah, that's right. And property is going to be a lot of things. It's going to be an interest, a present or future interest, a legal or equitable interest, a vested or contingent interest. Basically anything that exists or may exist or contingently exists in real or personal property, and that includes tangible or intangible property. And that would include things like retirement, passive or active income and earnings. Things like retirement are on the table as things that people can agree to as part of creating a prenuptial agreement. The agreement has to be in writing and has to be signed by both parties. And it's enforceable without the concept of consideration, as we know it in contract law. Consideration in this case is basically the marriage itself. Once the parties marry, that effectively creates the contract of the prenuptial agreement. I'm actually going to call it premarital agreement because that's the proper term in Florida, although it's impossible not to think of it as a prenup because mm-hmm. everybody uses
yeah,
that
right.
term. Now, the parties to a premarital agreement, they're going to be able to contract about a lot of things. I'm going to go over that list of things briefly, and then you'll quickly realize there's really nothing they can't contract to as long as it's not illegal. But typically in a premarital agreement, you'll see things like rights and obligations regarding property, personal, whatever, that parties have acquired before they were married, that they have now, or that they may acquire later. All of those things are typically on the table. as well as things like the right to buy, sell, transfer, abandon, lease or consume interests in mortgages, encumbrances, not only debts or not only assets, but debts and liabilities as well. Those things will be addressed as part of a prenuptial agreement. The disposition of property upon separation. See, the anticipation of separation is written right in the contract, as well as marital dissolution or death or the occurrence or non-occurrence of any of those events. The parties can make that part of their agreement when they're at the outset.
Could it include the language like, if we decide to split, you're not going to bother me, we're just going to do this thing? We're going to just, you know, there
absolutely.
Won't be... Okay.
Absolutely.
If so it... you can dictate the...
At the outset.
Virtual divorce?
That's correct.
Before
that's
you even get married?
Yeah. Okay. This is an anticipation of what may happen. And if it does, we're just going to go ahead
along.
And say this is what we're going to do.
Yeah, and you're not going to fight it.
That's right. We're going to have it in writing that this is how it's going to be. I mean, other things that they can contract at that time would include how to handle the establishment, modification, or elimination of spousal support. Alimony can be dealt with at the outset. And this has really specific application. I mean, every case is different. People come to marriages where they're already sort of set in what they want and what mm-hmm. they have. And they just don't want to mess with that in the event that there's a contingent situation whereby the marriage runs its course, or perhaps one spouse dies. They want to know at the outset how that's going to be handled. Everybody's going to be taken care of. Other factors include that they can address things like ownership rights in and disposition of death benefits from life insurance policies, for example, as well as the choice of law governing the construction of these agreements in the first place. Which state is going to, for example, have jurisdiction if this has to be addressed. And then really any other matter, including personal rights and obligations, it's not in violation of any public policy of the state or any laws that could impose a criminal penalty. So you can basically contract for just about anything.
Wow.
Is the bottom line. One caveat is that the rights of a child to support may not be adversely affected by a premarital agreement. So you're not going to address child support.
And what if you have children from another marriage and this will be a second marriage? Can you include anything on the children then? Because that's...
It's a good question. And the way you couched it, I would have to say yes because you said, can you? And yes, children could become a part of a prenuptial agreement in certain circumstances. However, ultimately, between children or four children of the spouses, if any, mm-hmm. those issues would not be addressed
right.
by prenup. They would have to be dealt with as part of the normal child support establishment process. Now, the effect of marriage is that a premarital agreement becomes effective upon marriage of the parties. Just to give the listeners a brief syllabus on contract law, this is essentially a contract situation. And a valid contract, as many of you probably know, consists of an offer, acceptance, and consideration without any legal defense to formation of the contract. Consideration in this instance is the marriage itself. So the consideration is basically the purpose for the contract to begin with. So in the case of a prenup, obviously the purpose of the contract is we're getting married.
But technically I can like come see you and go, you know, I'm going to need this prenup. I haven't met anybody yet. Mm-hmm. But when I do, these are going to be the rules.
Can you do that? Absolutely.
I can just carry that around with me until I find the right guy?
Right. You can put me on retainer to handle something like that for you, Veronica. I'd be glad to draft that up. I know we're coming down to the end here. Let's talk about real briefly enforcement. A marital agreement is not enforceable in an action proceeding under the family law rules if the party against whom enforcement is sought proves a number of things. Real quickly, those three things would be that the party did not execute the agreement voluntarily, that the agreement was the product of fraud, duress, or coercion, or that the agreement was unconscionable when it was executed. And before execution of the agreement, that party was not, for example, provided a fair and reasonable disclosure of the property, the financial obligations, the financial affidavit was not properly filled out. Those types of things might invalidate a prenuptial agreement. And I see that we are just about at the end. Thanks. All right. Well, thanks again for...
You wanted to go ahead and give your contact information again real quick?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, real quickly. To discuss these or any other issues regarding family matters or personal injury questions, contact me at my office at 772-600-8166. My office is located at 1025 Southwest Martin Downs Boulevard in Palm City. This is attorney Michael Raybuck. My law firm is Michael Todd Raybuck, PA. You may find us on the web at www.thefamilylawattorney.net. Thank you so much for listening today. Have a great weekend.